You're listening to Scribble Talk, an SMA exclusive, a sponsored podcast series from our friends at SMA. My name is Bhaskar Sundaram, and I will be sitting down with our SMA colleagues to share their stories, discuss their career, and learn how they are making an impact in the industry. Today's guest is John Rood. John has over 30 plus years of experience in national security positions in the United States government and private sector in international business, aerospace, and defense. He served as a senior official at the Defense Department, State Department, White House, National Security Council, CIA, in Congress as a staffer in the U.S. Senate, and as an executive at Lockheed Martin and Raytheon. Mr. Rood has been an associate at SMA since March 2020. In addition to his work at SMA, John serves as chairman of the board and security director of Radisson Hospitality Incorporation. He's also the chief exec of John Rood & Associates, LLC, where he assists clients with growth strategies and government relations in the US and overseas. I'm going to read through John's bio. It's going to be very interesting. Let's just start from the first one. From January 2018 to February 2020, John served as Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, where he led formulation and coordination of national security policy within the Department of Defense as the principal advisor to Secretary of Defense for such matters. He managed a team of 2,100 civilians and military service members and was responsible for building partnerships and defense cooperation with US allies, including overseeing the $55 billion foreign military sales program and export controls. Wow. John managed implementation of strategies, including the National Defense Strategy, resulting in a new focus on addressing the implications of growing competition among the world's greatest powers. He oversaw the development of new cyber strategy, authorities and approach a space strategy for the newly established Space Force, completion of missile defense revenue, nuclear posture review, a counter-terrorism strategy for the defeat of ISIS. That's serious stuff. Prior to serving as Undersecretary of Defense of Policy, John worked for nearly a decade in the private sector. From March 2016 to January 2018, he was a senior vice president of Lockheed Martin, where he was a corporate officer and direct report to the chairman and chief exec, charged with leading business growth and industrial partnership in more than 70 countries. He also served as a vice president for corporate domestic business development at Lockheed Martin. Prior to joining Lockheed Martin, John was vice president for US business development at Raytheon from 2009 to 2014, where he managed teams in Washington, DC, and 28 field offices responsible for growing the business, preparing market assessments, and managing customer relationships. From 2007 to 2009, John served at the State Department as Acting Undersecretary of Arms Control and International Security. He was responsible for policy on countering the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and missiles, arms control, nuclear weapons, security cooperation with other nations, and export controls. He also served as Assistant Secretary of State for International Security and Non-Proliferation in two tours at the White House National Security Council from 2005 to 2006 and 2001 to 2003. He served under President George W. Bush as Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director of Counter-Proliferation Strategy and Director for Proliferation Strategy, Counter-Proliferation and Homeland Defense. I haven't finished yet. From 2003 to 2005, John served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Forces Policy, where he was responsible for the development and oversight of policy and programs related to US nuclear conventional strategic focus, missile defenses, and space system. Earlier in his career, John worked as a senior policy advisor to Senator John Kyle of Arizona and as a fellow for Senator Thad Cochran of Mississippi on the Senate Government Affairs Subcommittee on International Security. From 1988 to 1999, John served in a variety of positions as analyst at the CIA, including following missile programs in foreign countries. John holds a Bachelor of Science in Economics from Arizona State University. I have to tell you, John, this is the longest bio that I've ever read in the podcast. Welcome, John, to Scribble Talk. Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you, Bhaskar. It's great to be with you. Yeah. I'll tell you what, as I listen to you read that, it's a 30-year career, but it was exhausting just listening to it all. But I've been very fortunate to have a lot of good opportunities. So thank you for having me today.
John, let's just go back and let's start from your early life and education, and then we'll slowly come to your career. Talk about where were you born, John, and let's talk about your high school and education.
Yes, I was born in Phoenix, Arizona. Mm-hmm. And at that time in the 1960s, Phoenix was a much smaller city than it is today. It's grown by the metropolitan area, probably about 3.5 or 4 million people since I grew up there. But it was very much the West in the United States, a spirit of independence, of self-reliance, and, you know, a certain amount of dislike of the various onerous regulations, or the perception that the Eastern establishment in the United States was trying to limit our freedoms in the West. And so I grew up in that environment and was very fortunate to have been part of a middle-class family there with my two parents, one who they later divorced when I was a child. And so I grew up living with my mother, who was a school teacher.
Wow. And Arizona is where, when was the first time you left Arizona? Was it for work, or did you had any interesting jobs before you left Arizona?
I only left for travel when I grew up in Arizona. Road trips, really, in the car to California, mostly, because that was about an 8-hour drive to get to Los Angeles or San Diego, which were the typical locations we went to. But there were some other trips in the car across the country that I would go on, mostly with my father, who was very, very attracted to that. I didn't leave Arizona, though, by airplane until I was in high school. That's the first time I'd ever been on an airplane. And my mother, who immigrated to the United States from Taiwan, she grew up in China and Taiwan, took me to Taiwan to see that side of the family for a visit.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. And we haven't even talked about the bio there. that's a good one. So, okay. So, University, Arizona State University, Bachelor of Science. Talk us through why did you pick economics as your subject? And was there any interesting memories when you were there a student?
Well, you know, it was a continuing path in my career where I have to say I did not plan virtually any of it. It's the best I can say is that when life events happened, I was able to react, or when I saw an opportunity, I was able to react and to take advantage of it. So my growing up in Phoenix, we were not a wealthy family. We really didn't have much money at all. We always had jobs as teenagers to make some additional money to spend and just to have to buy some things that we needed for the home, because my mother was a single mother and teacher salary is not very much. So she told me once, she told me 100 times, and as a Chinese woman, she was very into education, that it was critical that I get a scholarship. And so I went to, my initial ambition was to join the Air Force, and I got an appointment to go to the U.S. Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. But, and this would be a way that I could go to a very good university, that I could also have a career afterwards in the Air Force. And just before I was going to leave, I injured my ankle playing basketball, and I was in a cast. And so I showed up at the cadets going away dinner. There are 10 cadets per state that are nominated, and the 10 in my state of Arizona, we had a farewell dinner. And the day of that farewell dinner is when I got put in a cast for my injury. And the major in charge of the liaison office there from the Air Force, looked at me in on crutches in a cast and said, you know, when did all of this happen? And I said, well, today. And he said, have you been to a doctor? Yes, that's who put me in this cast. And he said, well, I'm going to send you out to see an Air Force doctor. I'll make an appointment tomorrow morning and you will go out and be examined by an Air Force doctor to see if you're okay to attend the academy. And I went and they disqualified me from attending the Air Force Academy due to my injury, because they do some basic training and other things in the summertime before the cadets begin their first year. And so I had applied to my local university, Arizona State, and I had a tuition scholarship there. And I still wanted to go to college, and that was really the only option for me. And I could stay at home and drive there, and I could get a job, which I did. And then with a scholarship, we could find a way that I could still go to college, and within the means that my family had. So that's why I ended up at Arizona State University. And once I was there, I really enjoyed the experience. I felt like it was a good education that I was getting. It really broadened my mind. Exciting time, frankly, as a freshman to see the intellectual exploration. And I enjoyed campus life and being around people that were exploring new things. And I couldn't figure out what I wanted to major in for a long time. I didn't select a major until I was a junior. And frankly, because I had to, I was indecisive. And the classes I was enjoying the most, I'd taken some economics classes. And then I decided, well, let me just try this. And I was really finding it intellectually stimulating to look at modeling, to look at how economic factors reshape our world and create different movements, monetary policy, creation of jobs, things of that nature. And so I just sort of embraced it and decided I would do that. But I was not again, I didn't plan my academic career well. I didn't plan my future career well either, in the sense that I ended up taking a very inefficient set of course loads. So I finished with almost a year's worth of extra credits because I took so many different classes and many different things to try to figure out what I wanted to do, but eventually settle on economics. Now, interestingly, I never worked in that field over my career, but that's what I got my degree in.
It's amazing. I have to say, unlucky to Air Force for losing you, and you know, lucky to every other companies and every other public sector who got you. You know, I mean, like, it, as you rightly said, you know, what everything is meant to be there for you, John, and I'm glad that you know, you just picked up one from strength to strength. That's beautiful. And I'm sure your mom is also listening, hopefully, and she'll be proud wherever you are. So that's good. So from economics in Arizona State University, what was your next role? How did you move into working for, was it CIA immediately, or was it some other roles that you took in between?
That was my first professional job. Obviously, growing up in Phoenix, I had lots of jobs at stores and restaurants and things, making ends meet, and during college to make some money. But my first professional job was at CIA. And that was also unplanned in a way. When I was at Arizona State University, I took one course that was taught by an IBM executive on business matters. And one of the things that he would do, literally at the start of every class, would say, here's the importance of getting an internship. And he would begin the class by saying, look, there are three internships for students at Pepsi Cola this summer. If you're interested, see me after class. I'll show you the flyer. Or there are two internships at Motorola. See me afterwards. And so one day he came in and he said, in the beginning, I was in the Career Center today, and there's a announcement from CIA in which they're looking for interns. So if you're interested, you know, go see the flyer there. And when I spoke to him after class, I said, can you tell me more about that? He said, no, I just read the letter. And so I went over to the Career Center, and in those days, prior to the internet and ubiquitous cell phone technology and things of that nature, I literally read a binder, a letter. It had an application that I took out my pen and I filled out the application and I put it in a mail with a stamp in those days and sent it off. And, you know, a couple months later, I got a letter back at my home inviting me for an interview. And I, you know, fast forward, I went for the interview and it's the first time I'd been to the East Coast of the United States and went for a job interview there for an internship and was selected. And I did that internship. Then they invited me back. Apparently I did a good job as a first year intern. So they invited me back for a second year. And it was fortunate for me, the section I was working in, the work I was doing, it was in the late 1980s, the Iran-Iraq war was going on. And there was a lot of chemical weapons usage by the Iranian-Iraqi forces on each other. And my job was to build some databases about chemical production and chemical precursors used for chemical weapons and things of that nature, just support work. And I didn't like it very much, but there was a person there that I struck up a friendship with who ran the missile analysis group. And he'd grown up in Arizona. He'd gone to Arizona State University. And he was much, much older, in his late 50s at that time. But he was talking to me. I think mostly he wanted to hear about what was going on in the state and what was going on in his old hometown. And so he would at lunch sometimes say, let's have a sandwich together, or other things. And he took an interest in me. And towards the end of the summer, he said, you know, next year, are you thinking about coming back? And I said, no, I don't think so. I don't really like that chemical stuff that I'm working on. And he said, well, why don't you come and do something for me in my branch and you can be an intern here. And so I did. And then I did that for a couple of summers. And then when it came time for me to graduate, he said, you know, have you ever thought about working here? And I didn't think I would get the opportunity because at the end of the Cold War, there was a hiring freeze on at CIA and they were reducing the workforce. And so I just assumed that was not even an option. I truly had never considered it because I just assumed they wouldn't be hiring new people. And I told him that. He said, well, technically you're already an employee. And so therefore you don't break the hiring freeze and we could extend a full-time offer to you. And I thought about it a little bit and I thought, you know, why don't I try that? I have no idea what I'm gonna do with my life. I was assuming I'd go to graduate school or something, but I thought, well, why don't I do this for a year or two while I figure out what I want to do? I like working there. I like the challenge of the work, and intellectually it was so stimulating and it felt good to contribute to my country's security. And I liked the guy that I would work for. So I agreed. And, you know, I moved to Washington and I've been here now about 30 years and I haven't moved back. And that's what took me away from Arizona. Although my family's still there and I visit regularly.
Perfect, John. So 11 years with CIA, and I'm sure you worked on multiple programs, both internal and external. Would you like to share some of your memorable projects while you were there, maybe without naming confidentiality or something, just maybe high level?
Sure. Well, I progressed, of course, from being an intern then to being an analyst, and I was in the analytic department. And in some ways, I lucked out as well that the man who, on my first day of work there as an intern, two people had shown up to escort me to lunch for the day and to introduce me to where I would work. And they had a little argument about where their intern was going to go. And the man from the Soviet analysis department finally relented and said, we have plenty of other options. You can go ahead and have the intern. And I was lucky because the biggest workforce cuts that later came were in people doing Soviet analysis. And I ended up going to an area which was focused on the Third World and in the analytic core. And I learned imagery analysis, how to look at photographs, how to derive information, how to do analysis of programs. And so my job was to follow missile programs in other countries and their development, which I did. And as a new analyst, I did that for a few years. And eventually, progressed to getting a new account where I followed North Korea's missile program. And that was very challenging because it's a very closed society, and the North Koreans are good at concealing their activities. But I followed that program for a while, and there were different task forces I was sent off to support, supporting the Gulf War effort or the negotiations with North Korea in the 1990s on their nuclear weapons program. And those were great experiences. And eventually, it gave me a broad enough based background that they assigned me to give a daily briefing for some key officials at the White House National Security Council. And that's where I first got some exposure to the operations in the White House and the National Security Council. And I thought, you know, someday I'd like to work there. And that's what set about my vision to pursue that at a later part of my career. But the very last bit of my time at CIE, they still have a tradition there of a lot of directed assignments. It began as a military organization, and there's still some culture around that. So one day, literally, I finished giving my briefings down the White House compound and was walking down the hallway to return to my office when a manager several levels above me who headed that section stopped me and said, "Hey, John, good news. Today, the career board, that's the group that meets to discuss all the people at different grade levels, met and to review people at your grade. And we decided that you will be our candidate to go take a fellowship working in the Congress." And at the time, I knew what that meant, by the way. When you're, quote, nominated, that means you're selected. The first couple of times I fell for it by saying, "Well, gee, how many other nominees are they?" And they would always say with a smile on their face, "Oh, one, you're the nominee. And it's voluntary, but we've all selected you." It's really not voluntary. It's just kind of a nice way of saying it. And I remember saying to him, "You know, I want a chance to be a first line supervisor. I don't know that that's a great idea." And he was very fatherly and quite literally put his arm around my shoulder and said, "John, this will be a great assignment for your career. You just have no idea what it will do for you." And he was right. So they sent me off to be a fellow. And the way that worked, you got some training on how the Congress worked from a group. And then as part of a federal government program, lots of fellows from different government agencies who were sent to the Congress. So I was in a group of about 100. And then you go and you interview with different offices. And I ended up working for Senator John Kyle from Arizona, my home state. That's not why I picked that location, but I had read sort of reviews of other fellows' experience. His office really stood out as one that used fellows effectively, valued them. And so I went there, and I was a fellow at first, and then he asked me to work for him, and that's what took me away from CIA. I went to work for him as a staff member, handling national security issues. Otherwise, I think I would have done a full career at CIA in the analytic department. Probably would still be working there today.
Totally, John. Totally. How was it, the transitioning from, you know, intense CIA into working for a senator?
It was a big difference. And that's part of what made it exciting and interesting. Mm-hmm. First of all, a Senate office typically has about 20 employees. Mm-hmm. A House member in the United States will be much smaller, maybe 6 or 7 employees. And so in the national security area, there were only 2 or 3 of us. And your work in the beginning, and we managed to get some other fellows and things to make it slightly larger. But the work that you do there ranges from the biggest national security debates, where the Congress and the Senate in particular on treaties must approve them. And there are other big debates that go on about priorities, how much to commit for funding for various things. But then there are other things where the companies in the state come to see you, the largest employers, and you deal with constituents too, just regular people writing letters, visiting, phoning. And so it was a good experience for me to do the highest of the highs that were at the lowest end as well, and get some experience doing all of the above. And so the senator I worked for was a leader in the national security area, particularly on things like treaties and defense programs. And so I learned how to get money for programs, how to advance certain programs of certain companies or things that you were in favor of. I was very proud of some of those accomplishments and some things like creating a new agency at the Energy Department focused on management of the U.S. nuclear weapons complex. Or there were some arms control treaties we didn't think were well put together that we opposed, one successfully, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. That led to the Senate's rejection. And I spent about a year architecting a legislative plan to defeat that treaty. It's the first treaty rejected by the Senate since the Treaty of Versailles. And so that was quite a legislative accomplishment. And I really got a lot out of that experience working for a senator, because you really learn about all the stresses and strains on the political system. You see some of the good and as well as some really, not so pleasant parts of the political process, and the way people can sometimes impress you so much with their commitment to doing the right thing or just their inspiration of being a leader. And then there's other times where you're pretty disappointed about the behavior of some politicians in some occasions. It's kind of an interesting mix of all of it.
Totally, John. I think that's just fascinating, really. And it's an amazing journey from Arizona internship take to CAA, from CAA to senator, and from senator you landed in as Secretary of Defense for Foreign Forces policy there. And you were there with the central government or federal government for 5-6 years there. John, would you like to share some of your journey as the Deputy Assistant Secretary and also the Senior Director President for Special Advisor to the President, and also at the State Department as well, please?
Well, when I was working for Senator Kyle, I came into contact a lot with people in the White House, the Defense Department, State Department. And when the election of George W. Bush took place, I decided I wanted to try to find a position in the new administration. And I started, looking at my network. And this is, of course, pre heavy internet usage. LinkedIn didn't exist, things like that. But I essentially did a link analysis of where there were people landing that I had worked with in the Senate that I thought I could pursue a good job. And so I ended up talking to some friends who introduced me to a senior official at the White House National Security Council, Bob Joseph, ambassador in arms control, and was leading the Homeland Defense Counterproliferation and Missile Defense Directorate there. And so he hired me to work at the National Security Council. And I spent a little more than 2 years there. And I worked on, at that time, we were trying to build a new construct, a post-Cold War construct for our relationship with Russia, to put in place a missile defense system for the United States for the first time, and to leave the 1972 ABM treaty that prohibited such a defense system. And I worked on those things very intensely, and it led to and supported the president's decision to withdraw from the ABM treaty that George W. Bush made. And we managed that relationship with the allies, with skeptical allies at first, who later became supportive, and with President Putin and the Russian government. And I also participated in the negotiations for the Moscow Treaty, which reduced strategic nuclear weapons to 1,700 to 2,200 per side, which was a big reduction at that time. And so that was just a fantastic experience. And I also used my North Korea experience there, where I later was assigned to work on the North Korea counterproliferation activities and support negotiations with the North Koreans to try to get them to give up to their nuclear weapons. Again, for the second time that I supported, the North Koreans signed a piece of paper they would do that. They just didn't live up to the agreement like they hadn't lived up to the earlier ones. So I did that work there. And then, kind of the way this works out in my life, I got a call from one of the people I was working with, who was an assistant secretary of defense in the Pentagon. And he said, I really would like you to consider coming here to be the deputy assistant secretary to lead the forces policy group, which does missile defense, nuclear weapons policy, and conventional strike. And, I was a little reluctant, but I went and interviewed and talked to him and ended up selecting and taking that job. And so that's what took me to the Pentagon in 2003. And I spent about 2 years there again, working on the, we had set in place the policy to leave the ABM treaty and to deploy a missile defense system for the United States for the first time. And I had drafted a directive that President Bush ended up signing, which ordered the government to take that step. Now I was in the Defense Department and my main task was, well, how are we going to stand this system up? What's going to be the policy on who we will protect with it, how we will use it to protect the American people and military assets? What's the command structure going to be like? What are the roles and responsibilities? How will we even make decisions on how ready for the system to be and when to take it offline for maintenance? And how will we cooperate with allies and what are the type of programs we want? And so I spent a lot of time on those activities. And I also led a review of our nuclear weapons stockpile, which resulted in a decision to reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the US arsenal, the largest reduction in history. And so those were my two big projects there. And I did a lot of international work. We negotiated agreements with Japan and Denmark and with the UK to use assets on their territory, radars, position assets to do cooperative activities. And then, as fate would have it, the person I'd gone to work for at the National Security Council, Ambassador Robert Joseph, left the administration to go to a new job at the State Department. And I had worked, Condi Rice and Steve Hadley were the two people I worked for as the National Security Advisor and Deputy National Security Advisor. And Condi Rice went to the State Department to be the Secretary of State, and Hadley was elevated to be the National Security Advisor. And he said, would you like to come and replace Ambassador Joseph as the Senior Director for Counterproliferation? And again, I didn't go looking for the job. Somebody called and the opportunity arose. And like usual, I was a little reluctant to go, but then I got my head around it and embraced it, and really am glad that I went to be back to the White House to be a special assistant to the president and senior director. Now I ran the counterproliferation section. And I did that for about 2 years. And then an opening arose at the State Department for an assistant secretary for non-proliferation, and Ambassador Joseph was one step higher, called an undersecretary. There are six undersecretaries of state. And he was always talking to me on the phone because we had to work on a lot of things together between the White House and the State Department. And he would tell me, why don't you come over here and do something like that? And I would always say the same thing. I haven't even been in this job a year. I couldn't leave earlier. And it was a convenient excuse, frankly, to get out of it. And so one day, when I'd been there over a year, we were on the phone and he said, "What's your excuse now?" And I said, "Okay, look, I was in a hurry. I wanted to get off the phone." I said, "All right, Bob, look, I'll think about it, okay? And I'll get back to you." And he said, "Really, you're gonna think about it now?" And I said, I'll think about whether it makes sense, but I gotta go. But seriously, I'll think about it, okay?" And when we spoke the next day, he said, I talked to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice and told her you were thinking about coming over here to take the position I want you to do. And I want you to know she's thrilled by that. And she told me she's planning to call you to persuade you to do it. And I said, you what? I told him, you talked to her about that? He said, yeah. I mean, I told her you're thinking about it. And I said, I'd think about it. I didn't say I was doing that. You know, and he said, well, you know, now she's on the trail. She wants you here. So, you know, don't make me have her call you. And I said, oh, you're joking around. She's not going to call me. Look, she's the Secretary of State. I don't know if I want to do it. Let me think about it. So I started seriously thinking about it. And two or three days went by where he was joking around with me saying, I'm serious. I'm going to have her call you. And I said, oh, look, you know, come on, stop with these threats. Joking, you know, she's not going to call me. And I don't know if I want to do it. Let me think about it. And sure enough, one day I came back from the White House Situation Room, and there's a little message on my desk that says, while you were gone, Secretary Rice called for you. And that's probably the only place I could have been in the White House Situation Room that they wouldn't have pulled me out of the meeting to speak to her. And, you know, so now I knew it was very serious. And fortunately, I called back and I didn't reach her that day. But the next day I went to the State Department for a meeting with the Indian Foreign Secretary. And she dropped in to the meeting to greet him, to welcome and spend about 5 minutes talking. And then she looked at me while we were standing there greeting him, said, you know, John, when we're finished here, I'd like you to accompany me down the hall. And so after she's finished speaking doing a drop by to greet the foreign secretary, she asked me to walk with her down the hall. And when we got to her office, as we would say in the United States, she put the arm on me and said she really wanted me at the State Department and really expected that I would come and thought it'd be a great thing for my career and great for the country. And, you know, 15 minutes later, I'd said yes, that I would come. And so that's how I ended up at the State Department as an Assistant Secretary of State for Nonproliferation. And then later she promoted me when Ambassador Joseph left from being an undersecretary to be the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security. And so that's how I finished out my term in the Bush administration. And I did a lot of work on nuclear nonproliferation, missile defense policy. I negotiated some defense trade treaties with the UK and Australia. I participated in nuclear arms control negotiations with the Russians, attempts to rein in Iran's nuclear program with the EU and with the Russians and Chinese as well. And then also I did a lot of work on India and changing the relationship with India and changing the global rules for nuclear trade with India, and was ended up being the lead negotiator on an agreement amongst the 45 nations called the Nuclear Suppliers Group that trade in nuclear matters, that changed the global rules to allow for civil nuclear trade with India. And there were important agreements we signed bilaterally with India that I was very deeply involved in. So I was very proud of that work as well at the State Department. And at some point of responsibility, I became a political appointee, which means at the end of the Bush administration, that ended my tenure in government. And so for the first time in my career, I went out to look for a job in the private sector. And I ended up going to work at Raytheon. I had approached all the significant defense contractors in the United States and tried to find out where I could be a good fit. I ended up getting job offers from Boeing and Raytheon, and got very close with Lockheed Martin after interviewing there. But I ended up selecting the position at Raytheon and ended up working there for 5 years, where I headed the U.S. Business Development Organization.
That's amazing. I was just visualizing as if I was just walking with you in White House. I think for pretty much every listener here, I think we all listen to that in the news. We watched it in the news. We get the stuff posted to us in the newspapers or social media. Was there any interesting experience that you had, like negotiating with any country or working alongside presidents kind of thing? How was that?
Well, you know, there are these interesting moments, and the funny thing is, big moments and things that later turn out to be historic, they arrive unannounced and always in surprising ways. And at least for me, in real time, you don't always recognize the gravity of the moment. So, for example, the first year I was at the White House, we worked literally to exhaustion every day, and you'd work all weekend, certainly all day Saturday until it was dark outside. And Sunday, you were often doing some things too, but you would try to take Sunday off. But Saturday was a work day. And, you know, in those intense moments, I can remember just being so fatigued that there are times where you're working hard to stay alert in meetings, or the first time you're in the situation room, or I was in the corner of the White House in the National Security Advisor's office. Part of what I was thinking in the back of my head was how tired I was, and, you know, reminding myself, stay sharp, be on this, you know, really dial in, you know, just like exhorting yourself to do things. And so one of my persistent memories of the White House is often how frenetic the pace was, and how taxing it was, both mentally and physically, to stay at your best. And some of the most important conversations I recall having, walking down the hallway briskly or quickly to get to a meeting, or just exiting a meeting in the West Wing or elsewhere, and the pavement or the blocks in the old executive office building, which is next door, which are a black and white checkerboard, you know, whizzing by as you're just completely devoting all of your mental faculties to the 3-minute walk in the conversation you must impart before a critical decision is made or a meeting is done. So those were things that were there. But the other thing that so impressed me is George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice were amazing. Just never met any people like that who could be calm, be still, be above all of that fray, and so organized and maintaining a strategic sight picture, no matter how many details or how many activities were going on, and how tuned in they were to people and how high their EQ was. That was amazing to me, how they could recall things about people, how they could remember them, and so and retain not a brusqueness or some of the things you would have expected, but part of the humanity of it there. And the White House is a smaller place than it looks on television and might be seen. It's actually a relatively modest sized facility. At the time it was built, the thought in the United States was that the main governments would be in the states. The federal government was going to be a small activity, and that the White House should not be imperial or something akin to a monarchy, but a more modest executive mansion. And so when you're doing work, that's one of the things I remember too. First time I was in the White House Rose Garden, President Bush was announcing the U.S. withdrawal from the ABM Treaty that I'd devoted hundreds of hours to working on to that point. It was a great accomplishment for me, but I remember standing there thinking, well, there's hardly anybody here. Gosh, this Rose Garden thing is really small. And, oh, my head is aching. I am so tired right now. You know, it's a historical moment, the front page of every major newspaper in the United States the next day, the lead story in the news. And I'm mostly thinking how tired I am, how rude the reporters are, and, you know, putting up ladders, being loud, pushing and shoving, you know, all these crazy things. And so history has a way of arriving in ways that are in real time, you know, just a little underwhelming, quite frankly. And then later you understand the gravity of it. And the longer I worked in similar situations, you do appreciate the gravity of it. For example, I gave a news conference after several years later, after concluding the negotiations at the nuclear suppliers group in Vienna to change the global rules for India. And a throng of 50 or 60 reporters were outside, at least half of them from India, in what would be a front page story there. And, you know, again, in the ceremony of it is never like on television. You're literally just on the street, surrounded by a gaggle of people shoving microphones in your face and tape recorders and things, and people jostling for pictures and video of it. And you just sort of speak. And then as soon as you're done, you know, the crowd disperses, or, you know, stragglers sort of throw last questions at you as you're walking away and so on. But it's not a very, you know, the decorum is low, the protocol. And so there were those moments. There are also breakthrough moments where you're surprised at the outcome at the negotiating table. But again, they typically are not accompanied by the drama you would see in a movie or on television. You know, it's much less ceremonial or majestic at the time it occurs. Often it's sort of, you know, the other party whispering and talking to their backbenchers, and people jostling with pieces of paper and things that they then, you know, push across the table, or you know, politely verbalize at the table that then close the negotiation. But it's rarely you know, the dramatic moment, even on the biggest of deals like a nuclear arms control treaty. It just, my experience is it rarely had that kind of emotion and drama. So, you know, it's a much more workmanlike situation there. And then, you know, when you're in the Oval Office with the president, I've served under President Bush and President Trump, and it's a dramatically different experience with either of them. With President Bush, he'd studied intently the materials that you provided for a call with a world leader or an important discussion, and he was impatient. This needed to move quickly. We need to get all the information on the table, and let's kind of rapidly hit the key traits. And when he spoke to foreign leaders, he always connected with them as a person first and developed a real rapport with them, and he coached us to do the same. And so that was very different. With President Trump, he doesn't typically read the briefing materials. He's very much sort of going by instinct. It was a dramatically different experience. I wasn't there very often in the Trump administration with the president in person, probably, you know, 25 times or something like that. But with President Bush, I saw him, you know, more consistently and regularly. And he did a tremendous amount of work in writing. It was a very different experience. And I was just, to this day, I'm so impressed with him and the way he worked. But we would put on briefing papers, you know, 3-minute pre-brief for president, 4-minute walk and photo spray. You know, it was down to the minute, the presidential schedule, how that would go. And with President Trump, it's very improvisational. He's making that up through the day as you go. So I, first time I went to arrive for a meeting that Secretary Mattis couldn't attend, that he sent me to in his place, I was kind of surprised. It started rather late. We didn't follow the schedule. And the sequence was, you know, made up as we went along. It was nothing whatsoever like what I'd experienced under President Bush, which was very tightly scripted and very disciplined. And, you know, kind of a tight execution priority is what he wanted to see.
Amazing, John Lee. The wealth of experience that you have at every level, A, for working for the central agency, moving on for senators, then, you know, drafting policies both at the central level and taking it all the way to federal level. After all these years, then you entered industry. How was it working for defense suppliers? And do you have any memories of, were you able to transferable skills that you had that you were able to lift from there to here, or did you face any challenges?
Yes, there were a lot of skills that I could transfer. But the big thing that was different is the first year I spent in industry at Raytheon, partly why I selected going to work there instead of Boeing is the senior vice president who headed the Washington office had done positions like that for a long time. And he, in his recruiting pitch to me, he'd said, you know, the biggest thing I can do for you is teach you industry and teach you how to grow. You have tremendous potential, but you're going to need to adapt quite a bit from the work you've done in government. And I can teach you that, and we're going to make an investment in you. And so that's why I went there. And he had told me he was interested in me for other jobs. And then to my surprise came back and said, I was interested in doing international work. I'd done a lot of work with other countries and their defense ministries at the Defense Department, State Department. And I thought that's where my main value would be. And he said, you know, we were looking at you for that, or maybe strategy, but we've decided that you should go work in U.S. business development. I said, of all the things that you have under you, I think that's the area I'm the weakest in. He said, you're right. I agree with you. And that's why we want to send you there, because we want to round you out. We think you can do the job well based on your Defense Department experience. And that's our main customer. But it'll give you a chance to learn. It'll round you out, and then it'll give you more upward potential to someday do even bigger things in the company. And so I said, okay. And they said, I've got one more thing for you. The next time we talked, actually, he rolled this out. He said, we were going to make you the head of the organization, but we've decided you should start as the deputy and work there for maybe 6 or 9 months. And I was rather taken aback and frankly, a little concerned by that. And he took the words out of my mouth. He said, now you're probably sitting there thinking, what happened here? And should I insist on the top job, or I'm not taking the job? And he said, so I'm just going to cut you off. If you tell me that's the only way you'll come to work here, you'll get the top job. But let me explain to you why it's in your interest to be the deputy for the first 6 or 9 months, because you need to learn industry and you need to learn this company, and it'll take the pressure off that you can do that learning. And then when the time is right, I won't commit to a time, I'll make the decision that you will then replace the guy who's currently the head of the organization, who's planning to retire. And so this will be part of his job to mentor you. And, you know, because he was so frank about it, I said, okay, I'll do it. I trusted him. And it turned out to be a very good thing, because I had to learn a lot. And that was a really weird period, quite frankly, that first 6 or 9 months, because you go from feeling like you're at the top of your professional game, operating quite literally in the Oval Office in the White House, or with the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, with senior people in other governments, and making things happen like treaties and other outcomes that are substantial. And the first month in particular, I was at the company, I would go to review after review at Raytheon. And, you know, Bhaskar, this hasn't happened to me since, where you quite literally leave the meeting and think, I don't know half of what those people just said. I was having a hard time in certain parts of the conversation following. What are they talking about? You know, I'm not familiar with that terminology. I'm not familiar with the way that they're handling the accounting on that. And so it was a real learning experience to learn the players, the products, the capture process, the tools that were necessary for business. And I went to some classes, and it was an unsettling experience, frankly, to go from being a senior person to sitting in a class learning finance and other things with people that are far your junior in age and in the company. But I just decided I'm not going to pretend here that I know how to do these things. I don't. And I'm just going to have to humble myself and take these classes and learn these things and really work hard here for the next 6 months or a year to come up to speed. I never had any loss of self-confidence, but there was an awful lot I had to learn. And, but you know, you can do it. And I came up the learning curve quickly. And, you know, after 9 months, I was put into place as the head of U.S. business development, and I still had more learning to do, but I ended up doing that job for 5 years, and I feel like did a real turnaround with the organization, and over time, participated in a lot of capture support activities or helping review captures, doing strategies for growing business in certain segments. And that's what I really brought to the table, is I understood how, from all my experiences, how defense programs are conceived of, how the services and the military operate, and then how the Congress funds them, and the role of the different departments and agencies, to include the State Department, if it's something that's going to be exported or dealt with another country, how all of those things interrelated. And so ended up having a really good experience there, and learning an awful lot in those 5 years I was at Raytheon. And then I went to work at Lockheed Martin. And the thing that took me away there is, when the person who hired me as the senior vice president at Raytheon left, they ended up, I was the designated successor, but it didn't work out that way. The CEO had someone who'd worked for him, and the business was being reduced from 6 business units to 4 in the corporation. And he was going to be left without a position, and he was close to the CEO, and he headed one of the P&L units, the 6 businesses. And so he put this other person in the job. And I didn't like that very much. I felt like the company hadn't really leveled with me about the plans and had led me to believe that there would be a different outcome. And so, it's an interesting thing. I started thinking about going to work for another company, or should I explore something else? And I was at a social event, and at my table was one of the senior executives at Lockheed Martin, who I'd interviewed with when I was thinking going to work there 5 years earlier. And he said, "Yeah, I heard about what happened there at Raytheon. That's too bad. We all thought you would be the one in that position." And I didn't really say much. We were just making small talk. And he said, "We haven't gotten together in a while. Why don't we find some time?" And when we did get together, he said, to my surprise, he didn't want to do it at like a restaurant or lunch. He said, "Why don't you come up to my office?" And when I walked in, he said, "I want to introduce you to somebody else. He's the senior vice president here for strategy and business development." And I had international, and we have some ideas if you'd be open to them about where you might be interested in coming to work here. And so that's what ended up taking me away to go work at Lockheed Martin. And I originally headed the corporate domestic business development organization, very, very similar job to what I'd done at Raytheon, business development in the US market, Defense Department, other federal agencies. And then I did that for a couple of years, and that went well. And Marilyn Hewson, the CEO, when the head of international was leaving, she said, I'd like you to do that role. And that's how I became the senior vice president for international there for the last 2 years of my tenure at Lockheed, which was, fantastic experience. I actually had more experience working in the international realm and growing business and doing strategy in that area that I'd done in government. Now I had the opportunity to apply it in industry, and that was just a great fit for me. We grew the international business significantly. I really enjoyed the company. I liked working for Marilyn Hewson. I had to learn some new things in the international world. The fun. And I felt very good about that experience. And there were 16 offices around the world that reported up to me. We had subsidiaries at Lockheed Martin around the world that typically I was the chairman of the board of the foreign subsidiary. And so I would spend a lot of time on the road in foreign countries, overseeing those activities, meeting with customers, looking for opportunities to grow our business, how to position the company. And that was just a great fit for what I wanted to do.
Wow. I can just keep on going like that. It's amazing. Thank you. Thank you. 10 years with the industry, again, you entered, you learned. That was so warm to just hear that, and you put yourself into the learning mode, learned yourself. And when things weren't working fair, you just moved on, and you just applied yourself in the international zone and even learned even more there. After 10 years with the industry, you again came back to support Department of Defense as the principal advisor. How did that happen, John?
Well, after the election of President Trump, I wasn't sure whether I wanted to go back into the government. I was really enjoying being in industry. I felt like I was having some success. And, you know, I started seeing where other people were, that other colleagues of mine from over the years were starting to rejoin government. And in some cases, that didn't make me want to do it more. But I looked at the Defense Department, and one of my coworkers, or actually he reported to me at Lockheed Martin, Bob Harward, was very close with Jim Mattis, who became the Secretary of Defense. And he was telling me about how the new administration was taking shape and other things. And Bob was approached and was offered the position of National Security Advisor to President Trump. And he and I were, you know, I was trying to advise him about that. We spent a lot of time while he was deeply considering it over kind of an intense 48-hour period. He ended up declining the job. But when he finished, he said, you know, I may go work for Secretary Mattis at the Defense Department. Why don't you want to go in? And I've been thinking about it. I dabbled in it a little bit. And I had talked to Condoleezza Rice to get her advice. And she'd suggested to me, you know, the Defense Department would be a good fit for you. And Jim Mattis could really use you there. And so those two people recommended me to Secretary Mattis. I'd never met him before. And he ended up having me come for a job interview. And because I was a little reluctant whether this was really going to be the right fit, and I'd known from serving government before, if you don't have the right fit with the secretary you work for, it's not going to be a good experience. So I spent most of the time interviewing him, frankly, not the other way around, which I later learned really impressed Secretary Mattis. Because I told him, look, I want to make sure there's a fit between your needs and what I can offer. And if not, I won't be doing a service to you or the Defense Department of the government if it's not a good fit. And so we had a great conversation. They ended up offering me the job. And I decided to go. And really the deciding answer, it was a tough decision for me because I was enjoying industry and I would be giving up a good career and you know, financially, it's financial insanity to go back to the government and take a 90% pay cut. But I just couldn't get out of my head that if I can help at this critical time for the country, how can I sit on the sidelines? And I thought I won't be able to live with myself that I, for instance, and decided for reasons that I, you know, more comfort and things of that nature that I'd stay on the sidelines. And I just couldn't do it. So I felt drawn to come back and I did, and I'm glad I did. It was a great experience working for Secretary Mattis and working with some incredible people like the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is a friend now, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs now, General Dunford, and others who just I admired so much and learned a great deal from. And I felt like I had a really good run for over 2 years there where we put in place some great things. National defense strategy, I'm very proud of. Did another review of our nuclear weapons policy and put out a new changed approach to that. Our missile defense systems and our approach. Key strategies for how we would deal with the various detainees and others who the Defense Department had grown to have detainees around the world in these various conflicts, how folks should be treated, what the proper way is to manage those affairs, a whole variety of things related to activities to prepare the country to deal with the challenge from China and to pivot more to the Pacific, work with allies. I mean, I was very proud of quite a few things we did while I was there. And then to my surprise, I had done that job thinking, you know, I'm going to not worry about whether what I'm recommending would please or displease some of the advisors around President Trump. And I said all along, I'll speak truth to power. If there's a time where I need to disagree or I need to say things that I think make recommendations, I will do that. And I'm not going to worry about if that pleases everyone all the time. It's a little different animal. The Trump administration is a very unconventional administration in that regard. And so in one of the many certifications that I signed on behalf of the government for the Congress, one of them was a certification that our cooperative program with Ukraine, in which we provided them $250 million, was dependent on Ukraine making progress in dealing with corruption and roadmap and the conditions in that assistance. And we're taking the proper steps to reduce corruption. And I certified that on behalf of the government. Now, a couple months later, turns out President Trump held the aid for Ukraine, and this became a big national story, and he ended up going through an impeachment proceedings in the Congress. And it was apparent that my certification was at odds with some of the things the president was saying to the Congress and others. And so, you know, after he cleared the impeachment trial, there were some officials who were asked to resign, and I was one of them. On the basis of that. But I feel very comfortable with that. I mean, look, what I certified was correct and accurate. I did what I thought was appropriate, and history looks very, very favorably on those decisions. And I had a good run for over 2 years in that position, which is the average 10 years less than that. And so I feel like I had a great run, and I look back with it with a lot of, you know, pride at what we accomplished and the difference we made. It was a little weird at the ending, but there's a long line of people in the Trump administration, similar things have happened to. That comes with the territory. I didn't go there out of any personal loyalty to any individual, to include President Trump. I went to the country and I got a chance to do that. And I feel very good.
That's super powerful there, John. Thank you for sharing. And you know what, every single time while you talk about it, I can see how emotional you can get in serving your country. And especially now, tomorrow being Thanksgiving, and I feel super happy and super blessed to have this conversation with you. You know what, and it is really amazing. Thank you, John, but thank you for serving for the country. John, while you were progressing your career, at what point did your mom say, John, I think I'm now happy with who you are, considering you injured yourself on the last day in your Air Force school? I'm sure coming from an Asian background, you know, your mom is super proud of you. At what point did she actually say it to you, or did she ever told you, or did you ask her for?
You know, she's always been proud of me, but she is very much an Asian mom that she's always been after me to get more education, that to be diligent, to work harder, save more money, be careful with your finances. And there's never been a time to include now, which she doesn't feel that way. And so when I worked for Senator Kyle, she was very proud of that. And when I went to work in the White House, she was very proud that I was there and could show her pictures of me with the president and things. And she would talk about that. But from the very first days of my professional career, literally until now, it's very common that she will, at some point when I'm visiting her, have a serious moment and say, you know, John, you never did get your PhD, and it's not too late for you. It's still not too late. This is very important for people to get the highest education, no matter what you think you've done. And you know, someday if you lose your job, that could help you get a new job. And it will develop you as a person, the pursuit of knowledge and being an intellectual is very, very important in life. And don't forget to study hard and to work more. Don't get complacent in what you're learning. And so she, you know, I think it's interesting, but for my mother, I tried for many years to say, you know, mother, I work at Raytheon or Lockheed Martin, and if I got a PhD, you do realize that they wouldn't pay me more, or I wouldn't get a promotion. Mm-hmm. And she'd say, yes, but then you would really be at the highest level academically, and you can do that. And someday you may want to teach, which there's nothing more important than giving knowledge to others. And even after you retire, you could be a college professor and contribute still to society. So she's always been proud of what I've accomplished, but you know, it's a different kind of pride where she's still exhorting you to do more, or worrying about you. You're not getting enough rest. You're not spending enough time studying and developing yourself or your physical fitness. And, you know, that's always been her message. And no matter how much money you earn, there's always a fear, you know, you better make sure you're saving enough. And she used to tell me, well, you have to put your children through college. And I said, well, I've thought that through and I saved enough money to do that. And she'd say, yes, but things can happen in life. You don't know, you know, be diligent, be prepared, be thrifty. You know, she'd been through World War II. And, you know, in her upbringing, I remember we always had a lot of food around the house. And she would always say, you just don't understand what it's like to be hungry. And you know, frankly, we didn't. We grew up in the United States. There was food in the house. There was never a time that we had enough to eat. And she'd say, you know, you don't understand what it's like when everybody in your family doesn't have enough to eat. And actually, everybody in the whole neighborhood or the whole city is spending the whole day thinking about where can I find food and where can I get enough to eat, and trying literally every day. So they're preoccupied. Their main existence is how can I find enough food to eat? And she said, and we went through that in the war, and you just don't understand what that's like to not have things. And therefore, you know, she was always telling us, you got to be careful. You have to save. You've got to be diligent in preparing yourself for unexpected things. It really had a huge impact on her life. Now, I mean, I took her lessons to heart, but you know, I didn't go through that. There's a certain amount of you that as a kid, you're difficult. You say, yeah, but there's plenty of food around here, Mom. That was before. That's not now. or don't worry. I mean, I have enough money in the bank that if I lost my job, I can survive. I can buy food. I can pay for the rent. But you know, she just always was preoccupied with that life. She'd had a different life experience. And I think that's why she's always pushing me. And for her, education was the way you were going to change your life. There's nothing more important than getting a good education.
Exactly. You know, you could have done the policy for George Bush. You still haven't got the PhD, John.
That's right. Nothing I've ever done would be as important to my mother as if I came home tomorrow and said, you know, congratulations, Mom, I got a PhD. Nothing would make her more proud of me.
Right. That's it. That's brilliant. You know, at least enroll yourself for a PhD and then do what it takes at the very end. But that's so nice of you, John. Thank you. It's a beautiful career that you had, 30 plus career, and then you came out of the office. Yes, it's unconventional, but what can you expect from him, right? And you know, that's what it is. And in this few months in 2020, you also joined SMA as an associate. Any few words about SMA and your interim stint with SMA as a part-time principal associate?
It's been a terrific experience for me. I knew AJ Patel when I worked, first in government, I'd met him. And then particularly when I was come to think of it, the first time I met AJ was when I was at Raytheon, where SMA did some work. And I'd been introduced to him, had the chance to participate in some meetings with him, and we stayed in contact then. And there was some work that SMA did for Raytheon that I was involved with. And then at Lockheed Martin, he was very helpful to me. And we developed a relationship, have dinner together. There were business opportunities for SMA with Lockheed Martin. But there were also things, you know, AJ was always very good about, you know, caring about you as a person and showing interest in you and being helpful. And so when I was back in government, I saw that the organization I had led really needed some help with management, needed help with workforce organization, that needed a reorganization. And there were just so many areas where SMA could help. And so I again met with AJ and Dave Patterson and others, and SMA was brought on as a consultant to me. And we did a lot of work there together very successfully. And so when I was leaving government, they said, you know, would you like to do some things with SMA? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. So I've been doing work as an associate with SMA since, I guess that would be April, beginning of April that I started. And I've really enjoyed the work. SMA, the market leader for in things such as capture, proposals, strategy, market segment analysis. And so I'm doing projects like that for different clients. And there's some things that AJ's asked me to look at as potential opportunities for the firm. And so I've been doing those activities. That's been a really nice experience. It's similar to the work, frankly, that I did at Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. Market segment analysis, looking at strategies for growth in targeted segments, business development for new opportunities, helping people think about how they might position their business to win government business in the future. So all of those things have been a part of what I've been working on at SMA.
That's nice. We talked a lot about your career, John. Let's just loosen up a little bit and then talk about your family, your hobbies and interests, and a few random questions here and there so that the next 30 minutes will be just all about you. So talk us through, John, your hobbies and interests.
Well, the positions I've had in government and in industry have been very intense. And so, you know, I've been very, very focused on my work. My non-work time. I have two kids. My daughter is now 19 and my son is 14. But, you know, spending time at their sporting events, spending time at their school events and things was always something I loved doing. And so time when I wasn't working, which is occupied so much of my time, was I really tried to focus on devoting the remaining time that I had to those kinds of activities. But it, you know, in terms of hobbies, I guess my main one would be, you know, some people have lots of things they do regularly, but I like history. I really like history. I enjoy visiting places that are historical. I like reading about people in particular, biographies or their experiences, and seeing what they did. Even if it's simple things like, you know, how did that get constructed, and the thought process behind it, you know, those kinds of things are very interesting. So sometimes, you know, reading a biography about a historical figure is interesting, but in other times, you know, for example, I really enjoyed a book called Brunelleschi's Dome, which is all about the construction of a cathedral in Florence, Italy. And the thought process that went behind it, and I got to visit that site at one point, and that meant an awful lot to me to see it. And so those kinds of things are really interesting. Or reading about Igor Sikorsky and his journey to invent the helicopter, those sorts of things really stimulate me intellectually, and I find them just you know, fascinating. So that's my main hobby. I would love to, as I have more time now, things more like fishing, which I like being in the outdoors. I like the peacefulness of it. The fish to eat is nice, but the experience of being outdoors and doing those things is really what I like. Hiking, especially in national parks or other things, is a great occupation. I like nature and all of those things a great deal.
100%, John. You had a full-on career for 30 years, and you know what? I'm glad part of your work life, you also traveled to many countries. If you could be anywhere else right now, where would you be and why?
Ooh, that's a tough one, because I do love travel so much, and I can think of so many places that I would like to be. It's been a really unusual period during COVID here, where I really haven't traveled anywhere since January. You know, I guess I'm very fond of I'm very fond of many places, but one place that would be fun to be right now would be in Paris. And I came in, the first time I went there was in the fall, like now, and I still remember being inside bistros and cafes when it was cold outside, and drinking a cafe latte for the first time, and other things. And that would be a nice return to enjoy, frankly, a nice warm coffee on a very cold day. And just being indoors and not having to worry about the spread of COVID or other things, that would be an awfully nice experience. And I guess the other place that would be sort of a co-equal tie for me is my children, and I have such great memories traveling with my children, my wife, to various locations, and being out hiking or in areas of nature. And it's just, to me, that was the best quality time we had together, was visiting things and talking about them or seeing them together and experiencing it together. And I would love to do that as well. And so, you know, when the situation gets easier for us to all travel, I'd love to do some things like that, and find ourselves again in wild and interesting locations, whether it's a sort of a rainforest in Hawaii or out in the middle of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado. We've had some great experiences in those places.
Wow, sounds fascinating, John. John, you did mention that you love history, travel, and you'd like to see, you know, both connecting together as well. If you could go back and have a choice, which historical figure would you like to meet and why?
Oh, wow. So many to choose from. That's an awful...
You can choose as many.
Well, you know, one of the ones that's probably not unique, but I've been thinking about Abraham Lincoln a lot in recent months, where, you know, we've gone through a tough period in the United States with societal unrest and concerns about, you know, equality, different visions for different parts of America. And the thing that so impressed me about Lincoln was, he had a steely resolve. Remember, he was insistent on keeping the Union together so much that he was willing to fight the Civil War. And, you know, people forget that he was a tough prosecutor of that war, if you will, that, you know, for example, at one point we have a right to trial called the habeas corpus, that he suspended that during the Civil War and said, those that are agitators for the South and undermining the country are not entitled to a speedy trial. But on the other hand, what so impressed me is, after, you know, the bloodiest, most difficult period in our history of just, you know, complete all out war, he was very forgiving. And he said, we're not going to treat the South as a defeated country. They're going to be an equal, and we're going to have them return to be a part of the country. And the country's about out of many, one, you know, e pluribus unum, from many. And we rise above and heal. And I don't know how he summoned that strength. The Confederate soldiers were not even asked to give up their weapons. They were just asked to stop the fight and to return to their homes. And they weren't going to be an occupied land treated in a subjugated way. They were going to return to being part of the United States. And that kind of, I don't know what you'd call it, wisdom and graciousness, kindness to others, it just, you know, really left a mark on me. I remember reading books about him as a boy, and bit of a strange character. I think he would have been unusual to be around in his mannerisms and other things, but incredibly endearing and humble. For, you know, his most famous address, which is chiseled in the Lincoln Memorial, is the Gettysburg Address. But he wrote it himself on the train on the way up to Pennsylvania. it's fairly short. He wasn't even the premier speaker. President of the United States is not the featured speaker. He is not the keynote speaker in the Gettysburg Address. There was a more famous orator who was given the prime speaking slot. And he didn't object. He didn't kick up a fuss. And he gave, you know, arguably the most famous speech in American history. So there's a grace and humbleness and impact there that, you know, he's probably the greatest president we've had. So I would love to be to meet him, to be around him and learn about those things. And then, you know, I think the one that would have been the most fun to be around might have been Winston Churchill, just because what a character and a colorful guy and impressive in his own way. I've been reading more about him and, you know, heavy drinker, heavy smoker, you know, not always the easiest guy to deal with, but tremendous leadership, amazing vision, and a grit and a, you know, presence to rally people that was very impressive. But, you know, he had great failures in life and he had great successes in life. And I think that would have been part of the interesting thing to be around somebody so colorful and to be inspired at times. And at other times you probably, you know, just, oh my God, what did he just do? What did he just say? But I think I would enjoy that immensely.
Totally, totally, John. Thank you for that. John, in your free time, do you listen to music? If so, what type of music do you listen to?
You know, I do listen to music. I like a lot of music and I listen to, I've got a pretty broad taste. I do like popular music, you know, top 40 music. My children at the moment are really into K-pop and I have to admit, I started listening to that and I got into a bunch of that. But I also, you know, I was driving somewhere earlier today, I was listening to country music. And I like the storytelling in particular in country music. And then there's a lot of what we would call standards, older American music that particularly in the evenings, just, is the right thing for me to listen to. So last night I spent an hour listening to Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, one of their great collaborations. And these are very standard ballads, but it to their voices and the music, it in some ways it teleports me back to another time. And I really enjoyed the heck out of that. So I've got kind of unusual musical taste and that I listen to a lot more different ones depending on my mood, and it seems to, you know, fit very well to either relaxing me or pepping me up or things like that. And of course when I go running, it's got to be something with an edge. You know, a lot of blaring guitars and metal music and things like that, otherwise it doesn't make my legs go. So
totally, totally, John. John, we are in this COVID climate. So who haven't you met in a very long time and you hope that they're doing okay?
Wow. That's a hard one. But, you know, after the COVID situation hit and I just stopped traveling, I have to say I had in December, I had seen Secretary Mattis, who I used to see every day. Frankly, we were at a conference together. We ended up having a drink and catching up. And it was just great to see him. And frankly, I assumed he would be in Washington and we'd see each other monthly, or I would be on the road and, you know, we'd find time to get together or other people like that. And I hadn't seen him since the end of last year in person. And so that's a big surprise to me, you know, because I'd gone through a period of just, you know, intense work where we saw each other all the time. And even after he left, I was staying in touch. So that's unusual, you know. On a more family note, normally I would have spent time coming up here for a a couple weeks at the holidays in a big family gathering, both with my own mother and father, sister, and then my in-laws, which is my wife's side of the family, is very large. And so, you know, be very common to be in the house full of 25, 30 people. And none of us have seen each other since the COVID situation really became serious. So that's a big adjustment. And the holiday season will be. We're all going to be separate this year. So that'll be a disappointment. But it'll end. This too shall pass. And we'll be okay. But it's just going to be a little bit of a shame that this year won't be quite as merry as some past years.
100%, John, 100%. John, just visualize you're sitting alone in a big field looking at stars. What do you think you will think or feel?
Oh, boy. You know, the things that I, in moments like that, I tend not to be thinking about work. If I find my mind, because I tend to have my head down during the periods of work, and it's hard for me to, I'm very focused on what I'm doing. And so in moments of reflection like that, if I find myself drifting to my to-do list or thinking back on some project at work, I actively divert my mind to try to think about much broader things. And so often in those moments, staring up at the sky or being out in nature, I'm just trying to think how small I am compared to that huge universe. And thinking about either the sweep of the of nature or what's moving around me or the size of the mountains or the listening if I'm on the beach or something, the huge ocean. Or you know, if you're in a creek area or something, the movement of the water, and just trying to lose myself in all of that and think in context that I'm actually a very small part of this big moving. So things like that, or I my mind ends up getting diverted to historical things and thinking of them in context, or just finding it interesting to think about what people a long time ago would have been doing in either the same place or some other part of the world. And it, you know, and it just, I find it amazingly, you know, stimulating to think about those things.
Totally, John. I can see that. John, if you could ask one question to your son and daughter, what question would you like to ask?
Yeah, one question. You know, I guess it'd be, you're always trying to figure out what makes them tick, and or at least I am, and what would be stimulating, or what is it about some of the things that they really got into or are into now that I could replicate or turn them on and something else new that they could do with me. You know, especially now they're older, they're much more self-sufficient. Ironically, when I have more time now, they're they're much more, as teenagers or you know, young adults, they've got a lot of things that are occupying them. So it'd be, you know, what would be fun to do, or what could I get them interested in to do still with their parents, and that would be a, you know, nice bonding activity.
Totally, John, who are the people who have been the most influential in your life and career?
Well, certainly my mother is shaped me and continues to shape me more than anybody else. And I lucked out. She was a very disciplined, very stern, very loving person. You know, not high on the touchy-feely side of the equation, but thank God I had her to get me started in life and to you know, insist on that I was good enough to do things and to motivate me and to love me and care so much about my future. So I was very fortunate that way. So definitely her. You know, I'd say other people who had a big impact on my career, Ambassador Robert Joseph, who I worked for, really kind of helped mold me into, he could be very demanding for what he wanted and the standard of excellence and the timeliness and how rapidly things needed to be done. But, you know, I learned so much from him about how to be effective in government, how to work in the national security realm. And he was a key mentor and still is to this day for me. Now he's a tremendous gentleman and really never seems to lose his temper with other people and has a way of conducting himself that I wish I could be as good as he does, and his ability to just know so much about the national security environment. So, you know, I'd say among my mentors, he's been a very, very influential one. But there were I've had other very fortunate mentors too. As a matter of fact, one of the people I briefed at the National Security Council when I was a CIA analyst, we developed a friendship, and he's been a mentor of mine and didn't have to show an interest in my career, but did. And that made a big difference in who I became. And then the interesting thing is along the way, you know, other people end up saying and doing things, sometimes in shorter bursts or in shorter durations in your life that end up having a big impact. And I still remember when I was an intern at CIA, the man that managed the interns named George Farmer. You know, we were young people, typically around 20, and many were minorities, you know, quite a few Black students or others. And I remember him saying to us as part of his coaching, now remember, at first, very gently, you're conspicuous here. You're not going to see very many employees your age, and they don't look like you. And you're not going to see as many minorities. They don't dress like you either. They don't talk like you. And so you're very conspicuous here. Now remember that. And he would say, so number one, you do something inappropriate or out of the norm, I'm going to hear about it because you will be noticed. And secondly, if you do something out of the norm that's good, you will be noticed. You will be conspicuous. And I'll hear about that too. And that's good. And so, you know, I thought that was interesting advice. But then later, I remember he would get together with us. And another time, one of the other interns was complaining that he'd gotten in some trouble for calling in sick, and he wasn't sick, and some other things like that. And he said, you know, they're being awfully hard on me. And complaining, you know, maybe that's because I'm young or I'm a minority. And, you know, I still remember George really, he made a big impact on me when he got angry at this boy and the others of us and said, I keep telling you, you are conspicuous here. Now you can see that as being a victim, or you can use that to your advantage. You do something like you just did, you are going to be noticed. And because you are conspicuous, and you are going, other people might be able to get away with it because that's what he said, but you won't because you stand out. Now, if you do something well, you stand out. And I am telling you, you can use that to your advantage in the way if somebody else does a good job, they will not be noticed because there's all kinds of other people that are similar to them, but there aren't people like you walking around these hallways. And, you know, get your head on right and use that to your advantage. And I remember when I was a new analyst, as I told you, they'd had a hiring freeze, and I, to my surprise, they could just hire me because technically I was an employee as an intern. And, you know, I remember briefings or presentations or work that I was doing on feeling like, oh my God, the whole eyes of the world are on me. I stand out here like a sore thumb. I'm the only one at my grade or my age or what have you. But, you know, I remembered what this man said, and I thought, I'm going to use that to a huge advantage and really prepare the hell out of what I do and just try to make, you know, my work or some things where I'm going to have a lot of attention on me the best I could possibly make it. And it paid off hugely for me because we were conspicuous. I was conspicuous. Other people were doing similar work, but mine really got noticed. And I don't think I would have had the same benefits. So in a weird way, these, you know, while he was only my intern coordinator for one summer, for 3 months, made a big impact on me that, you know, this can be a very positive thing, actually, if you take advantage of it. And so, you know, there's a lot of people that end up affecting your life in similar ways. And I feel very lucky that I had some good ones who made an impact on me. Now, I mean, the coaching I give to young people is you got to be open to that. If you're going around all day thinking you know everything, and frankly, I think a lot of millennials suffer from this, or thinking you've got the world by the tail, or the world owes you something, or what have you, or you've got a culture of victimhood, you're not going to take these coaching lessons. You got to be open to it. You have to have a mind where people are willing to be your mentor, or if they give you good advice and you think it's good advice, well, then you've got to follow it. And, you know, too often I saw, especially early career people when I was at the companies, weren't always open to coaching or advice. And typically they were the ones that derailed and didn't succeed. So I feel very lucky that I happen to have some really good people in my life.
100%, John. Especially, I like the story about being different and how you can evolve from that. That's amazing, John. Who's the kindest person you know?
You know, probably my best friend, Ricky Ellison, and you know he had grown up also in Arizona, but elsewhere, and was living at a boys' ranch in a remote area of the state when he got an opportunity to go see a USC football game. And he took a train ride to Los Angeles, watched the University of Southern California play. And, you know, he decided, I'm going to go to this school. Took out a piece of paper, wrote down at age 12, I'm going to go to USC. I'm going to play football. I'm going to marry a USC cheerleader, and I'm going to play in the Rose Bowl. And he ended up doing all four things. And then he had a career as a professional football player in the NFL, won Super Bowl rings, and has had great success. But, you know, he works on a charity for inner city boys that he started himself, where I've worked on the board now with him. And the passion he has for helping these young kids to have a similar experience and from some of the roughest neighborhood, the most violent in the country. And the passion he has about raising the money, about personally interacting with these boys, about changing the trajectory of their lives. That's probably the kindest, you know, person I know of who really devotes himself to that. And for no particular reason other than he feels like this is something that he can give back and do. So that really impresses me.
Totally, John, totally. John, if you could describe your wife in one word, what would you say?
One word? Boy, you know, it's a good thing she's not here. Whatever word I picked wouldn't necessarily cover it all. I guess I'd say comprehensive. She has a way of being very comprehensive about what she's doing from the beginning of the recipe to the end of the recipe, from the beginning of the activity to do something in the house or change a room or the way each detail, you know, it's very interesting to see how her mind works about those things or all the details of how getting the children and I and her to do some activity or go from one place to another and the number of comprehensive details that she's thought about. I guess I'd go with that, which is probably not the most flattering. You know, it's a good thing she's not here. I should be saying something like beautiful or charming or, you know, something like that. But
I can tell you, John, whatever the word you pick, you're just going to find why you didn't say that anyway. So that's good. You know, you are.
That's right.
I'm glad that you shared that. I'm sure because when you had a full-on career, I'm sure your wife was your rock behind you and she supported the family so that when your children grow up, I mean, like, you know, it's hard. And when they're behind a successful person, there is always two sides, right? and I'm sure she played a massive role on your success. So definitely.
Oh, yes.
John, we talked about your life, your career, a few things about your family as well. Now, John, what's the best piece of advice you have received and from whom?
You know, the story I told about George Farmer saying you're conspicuous and use that to your advantage. I really think in my early career, that was the best piece of advice I received and how to implement it. You know, I guess the other thing that I would say is Ambassador Joseph really impressed on me that when you have, you're working on something in the security realm or in your life that you think is important, that be true to that thought, that vision. That doesn't mean that there aren't times where work out like you planned, or maybe somebody more senior in the organization changes that. But don't curtail or tailor your advice based on what they want to hear. Be full-throated and true to what you really think the best decision is, or the best thinking is, or way to handle something. And be sincere in putting that forward and respectful. And if they don't accept it all, that's okay. I mean, you don't pout or become angry or disaffected or somehow undermine the team. But don't tailor what you're saying based on what these folks want to hear. Be very direct. Be very, you know, sort of intellectually forceful in putting forward your beliefs. And over time, they'll respect that more, even if there's a disagreement. But also, you know, you're making a lot of assumptions about whether, if you're just telling people what they want to hear, whether what you truly believe in can't be put into reality. And so, you know, that's really served me well. And whether you're in companies or other things, saying, well, you know, the boss seems awfully enamored with that plan, I can't, and you're looking at it thinking, I can't see how that works. We're not going to win with that win strategy, or and this just doesn't add up. We're not going to get to our price to win number, or, you know, look, I know that the business has put forward certain growth targets, but as I look at those assumptions that's based on and really try to think critically about it, I don't see it. And having the courage to simply say those things, you know, respectfully. And like I say, not every time do you turn the tide or people listen to you, but more times than not, I found they do. Or frankly, not always in real time. Sometimes that creates some friction in real time. But then later, I felt rewarded for having the ability to say those things. So that was a great piece of advice, because it let me do more both in government and in industry. And people that were always trying to, if you will, play the angles, figure out what does the boss want to hear, how does he want to hear it, I found it really didn't end up paying off for them. Maybe sometimes in the short run, but not very well in the long run. And being willing to question things. That's one of the things I think that helped me stand out at Lockheed Martin. The second job I had there, where Marilyn promoted me, and one of the early, when I was brand new, I'd spent a lot of time looking real hard at the price to win aspect of a strategic capture. And first time I was ever in a significant meeting with her, I was really pressing the team on, I just don't understand how this adds up. Explain it to me. And you know, eventually forcing them to acknowledge, look, we just can't get to the numbers that your analysis is correct, John. We didn't get there. And saying, well, if that's the case, I don't understand why this isn't a no bid at this point. And just without regard to the personalities in the room or the situation or the awkwardness of it, just being true to the intellectual conclusions that these various things would lead you to. And it really made an impression on her. And, you know, ultimately saying, okay, look, in this case, the P&L leader saying, well, we still want to proceed, you know, accepting what you're saying, John, but, you know, we're going to proceed anyways. Okay. You know, look, ultimately that's your decision, but, you know, let's talk then about what can be done, because that's not going to get better. So we better look at some other parts of the offering. Now, ultimately, they end up losing that competition like I thought they would. But, you know, having the courage to say it and being willing to put forward your views and in a way that's respectful but that is direct was a great piece of advice that I and training I learned from Bob Joseph.
Very powerful, John, 100%. John, it's close to 2 hours. This is one of the longest, and by far, I'm sure we could continue even more, John. But looking back, anything else you would like to add to this conversation, or is there any part of your life or career that we have missed that you would like to run through, John?
You know, just I guess a feeling that I don't feel like I'm anywhere near done yet in my career. That's part of what I like about working at SMA is chance to do new projects for new clients in interesting ways. And some of the things I've gotten to work on, you know, with AJ or with other interesting people has been great. It's really stimulating. And for me, I just hope I continue to get opportunities to do interesting things, to be challenged, to learn new things. And occasionally to get thrown into unusual environments where you don't know all the answers. That's part of the fun, is figuring it out. So I guess, you know, that's where I'd leave it with. I'm in a period like that now where I'm doing some new things besides at SMA, serving as chairman of the board of Radisson Hospitality and learning the hotel business and some other things like that. And that's part of the fun of life. And so I'm pretty optimistic about the future, and, you know, hopefully we can talk again in 10 years and there'll be a whole bunch more things to talk about. New chapters.
100%, John. This is just the beginning of a conversation, John. Totally. So thank you so much for taking your time to join Scribble Talk, John. It's been an absolute privilege to have you with us. And please do share my love and wishes to your mom, to your family, to all your colleagues, every side, industry, government, you name it, your neighbors. All the good health and happiness, John. Look after yourself. Stay healthy, stay happy, stay sane. Keep smiling, John.
Okay, very good, Bhaskar. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you, John.
To our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. Please visit batchyscribble.com/podcast to listen to this episode and check out any of our other previously recorded episodes. If you've enjoyed today's interview, don't forget to subscribe, review, and share the Scribble Talk podcast. We hope you'll check out our next episode where we interview another industry expert and special guest. Until then, it's Ashley Kays,
Bhaskar Sundaram,
signing off.